That was the Backseat Lovers with Maple Syrup. Before that, the Sponge Tones with Honest Work. Toad the Wet Sprocket with California Wasted. Primal Scream with Velocity Girl. And we started set off with Randy Newman and Mr. President, Have Pity on the Working Man. Support comes from Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Whether you're looking for a casual place to study or a great place to meet friends, we are here for you. Always serving scratch-made pastries, a full coffee bar, and six packs to go in a cozy cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Okay, back at it. Next up, we have The Clash with I'm So Bored with the USA.
Yeah. lips met in the orchard mist and lingered longer than any human man could resist. And now I'm all in till we fall out. That's what they used to write that poetry about. I had the longest kiss, the longest kiss I've ever had in my life. I think I found my wife. Nothing compares.
Wheel Workers with Wage Slaves. Before that, Cool Life with Young Demon, The Darkness with The Longest Kiss, Foxy Shazam with Magic, and we started it off with The Clash, and I'm so bored with the USA. Hey, there's one other show you should be listening to here in WRCT. Do you remember that kid you picked on in high school? Well, we gave him a radio show. Tune in and hear the Moxster spin the best and worst in indie, punk, classic country, power pop, and so much more. That's Viva La Mock, Friday night starting at 9, exclusively here on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. Okay, next up we have Sweet Honey in the Rock with More Than a Paycheck.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more. Pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, long, long, black, long disease. And radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I wanted more to pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis for round, long, black, long disease. And radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more
than just a little paycheck.
Cause it's important that you know that whatever we job there is the fear that disease will take its toll. If not disease, then injury. My Lord, maybe folly or not. And if not injury, then stress is going to tie you up in knots. So we take home
more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family.
Bring asbestosis
and silicosis, round, long, black, long disease. And the radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more
than just a little paycheck.
We bring more than just a little paycheck.
A paper here,
much more. But I don't want no more. Don't accept no more. Don't tell them all no more.
There's power in the fight. brothers and our sisters, many bar of lands. There is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that I realize brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. But who'll defend the workers who cannot organize when the bosses send their lackeys out?
trenches and his worn out cowboy boots. He walked like no man on earth. I swear he had no name. I swear he had no name. Come on down and meet your maker. Come on down and make the stand. Come on down. Come on down. Come on down and make the stand. As I crawled beneath the searchlights, looking through the floorboards of this life, I met Dr. Strange once, cousin, before the march of time. Hey, trash can, where you going, boy? Your eyes are feet apart. Is that the end you're carrying? Shall I play the funeral march? Play the funeral march. Come on down and meet your maker. Come on down and make the stand. Come on down. Come on down. Come on down.
Before that, R.E.M. with Finest Work Strong. That was actually the Mutual Drum horn mix, which I prefer because it has horns in it. I generally like that. Before that, the Gourds with All the Labor. Billy Bragg with There Is Power in a Union. We start that set off with Sweet Honey in the Rock and More Than a Paycheck. That is just going to about do it for me. This is DJ Chris Wired. I want to thank you for listening to this Labor Day weekend edition of Breakfast for Dinner. We will be back next week with some more music. Until then, I'm going to leave you with Elvis Costello and Welcome to the Working Week. Thanks for listening.
Now that your pictures in the paper being graphically admired, you can have anyone that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is why.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh.
Cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism as it did so became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Masha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan wrote it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning, a political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who, in their view, was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy, in their view, was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story. But it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy, and they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism, because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president. And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States move the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the US, gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government. But it is not just exercising domination over others. It is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military, after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But you know with me, there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their end game, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman, and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a settlement house worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. "I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere," Perkins recalled after the fire. "It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face." With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins, the primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality.
But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So
this is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the effort of the Trump administration, largely successful, to take over the opposing institutions in our society, including Columbia University.
Our guest, retired Columbia University.